As destructive as they are, plant diseases can be intriguing. So intriguing that our guest wrote a book about some of them using limericks. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us today. And who else but Dr. Death himself, Brian Huddleston, would write this fun little book. Brian is the director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. And he recently published this fanciful little book of limericks. They're based on common and uncommon plant diseases and fungi or fungi. Brian, welcome back.
Hi, Jill. How are you?
Thanks for having
me today.
So how do you pronounce F-U-N-G-I?
Fungi.
Fungi. Okay. Fungi. Well, I looked it up. Apparently, there are like three accepted pronunciations. So
you can pronounce it any way you like, as long as I understand what you're saying.
I don't care.
And that's a common problem when I'm dealing with talking about fungi that cause disease, because it's all Latin.
And so
you look at these words and it's like, how on earth do you pronounce these? So as long as I can figure out kind of what you're saying, it works okay.
Wonderful. Well, you've been with us on Garden Talk for a really long time, but you know what? I don't think we ever asked you, how did you get into plant pathology? What brought you to this?
I was interested in plants from an early age because my paternal grandparents had taken their yard. They lived in Normal, Illinois, and they had naturalized it. So I was exposed to wild plants forever and ever, and I found that really fascinating. And then when I got into high school, I originally kind of wanted to be an archaeologist, but I had a really, really good biology teacher who focused on plants. She loved plants. And in fact, I'm still in contact with her after all of these years. We do Zoom meetings about once a month. And she got me into plants and got me into doing research. And I actually started out in college as a botany major, took a bacteriology class to fulfill a requirement for that, and thought, oh, bacteriology is kind of fun. So I'll double major in botany and bacteriology. And then by the time I got done doing all the requirements for that, I was one course away from getting a molecular biology degree. So I picked that up. And it was like, okay, what do I want to do to kind of combine all of these things? And the logical area was plant pathology. So that's how I ended up in doing what I do now. And I love my job. I have the best job in the world, quite frankly.
We can tell you have a good job.
I love what I do. I get to see the craziest, funnest things in my lab.
I'm oohing
and eyeing over some photos this morning. Someone sent me of a rust disease on bellflower that I'd never seen before. So it's like, oh, wow, a new disease.
Well, that's great for you, not so much for the person sending it.
Although people understand I'm very eccentric. My nickname is Dr. Death. So they're quite tolerant of my going ooh and ah over plant diseases.
Okay, so I know the backstory of how the little book came into existence, but why don't you tell us where the inspiration came from?
Yeah, actually, the first time I dealt with limericks in a professional sense was about 30 years ago. Actually, I was director of what's called the UW Ginseng Research Program, and had a little downtime one day. The three of us who were on staff, it was myself and Ann Joy and Nancy Kurzweil, we came up with this limerick about a ginseng disease, and that has been taped to my incubator in my lab for about 30 years. And so when we kind of got into COVID, I was trying to think of ways that I could program a little bit differently. And primarily my demographic that I tend to interact with is an older demographic, so adult education. And so I was trying to think of a way of perhaps getting younger people interested in plant diseases. And I saw that limerick on my incubator and I thought, well, maybe limericks might be an in for doing that because they're kind of fun. They're kind of silly. And so that started me off writing this book. So it's called Limerickhetsia, which is a word mash. Actually, it's limerick and then rickhetsia, rickhetsia is a type of disease causing organism.
Yes. So. And it's difficult to say, by the way. Thank you, Brian.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I appreciate that. Tell them what it looks like, because I've got one here in my hands, and I was just surprised. It's really beautiful.
What I did was I wrote the limericks to start with, and then I decided, okay, I need more than that in the book than just the limericks. So it's kind of set up. The setup is on the left panel as you open the book is the limerick, and on the right panel, there's a prose description of the disease with information on, you know, the organisms that cause the disease and how to manage it. And there's some, for some of them, some historical information as well. And then I thought, okay, I need something hopefully pretty to look at so I could get photographs. So there's some photographs of the disease. And then I thought, okay, I want some artwork. And I actually did the artwork myself. It kind of frames the limerick, frames the prose descriptions. And I have to say, that was the most fun part of any of this, was that I'm not an artist and I was able to do this artwork. And I'm pretty proud of that, because like I said, I'm not an artist. So it turned out, I think, to look pretty good. And it's very colorful, which I think is important for this topic. Because we're talking about death and destruction here, a lot of kind of negative connotations, and you need something that's, you know, bright and colorful and makes it attractive when you look at it.
Well, Brian, I do have an art background, and I can tell you, you're an artist, whether you like to hear it or not.
Well,
you are.
If you want to know the truth, I really didn't have any art programs to do this in. So I did this in PowerPoint, which is a...
Oh my gosh. Wow.
So PowerPoint is pretty powerful in terms of what it can do artistically. So I was familiar with that program, having put together a lot of talks through the years. So it's just, I kind of experimented with that. Discovered some things down the road that I wish I had known about when I first started doing the art pieces, but it turned out pretty well. I'm pretty pleased with what happened.
What I love about this is, okay, you've got this beautiful color, but you've got to look at what it's made of, because it's got the disease itself is kind of worked into the frames.
Yep.
And so each one is different for each disease.
So they're all tailored to the particular disease that I'm writing the limericks about.
Yeah. What a fun book to give away, too. Great gift.
Yeah, I've given quite a few. And I have to say, I'm very grateful. I wanted to do all the photography myself as well, but I soon realized, given that some of the diseases I was talking about don't occur here in Wisconsin, and I have to go to places like Florida and California in order to try to get photos, and I might not ever get really good photos, that I was going to have to ask for help in terms of the photographs. And so I contacted a lot of colleagues and just some people that I didn't know at all and said, hey, I'm doing this really weird project. Would you allow me to use this photograph that I found that you've taken? And invariably, people were bought in and said, sure. And so if you go to the back of the book, there are a lot of photo credits for all the people who helped with the project.
I want to have you read one or two of these just to kind of give people a taste of what they'll see. Let's start with the tobacco rattle, which you've got on page 8.
Yeah, I have to say I really like the artwork on that one. That one that came out particularly well.
It's very pretty.
Yeah, so that particular one, it's on leaves of the fair bleeding heart, a virus that rattles does start. Like a bolt from afar or a famed wizard scar, it makes plant disease find modern art. And I love this particular disease because the symptoms are incredibly pretty. I see it on bleeding heart. I have a bleeding heart in my backyard that's infected with this virus, and it shows these lightning bolt like symptoms on the leaves. It's incredibly pretty, and that's where the famed wizard scar comes from. And
Yeah,
and if you didn't know it for sure, there are certain art parts of the art pieces that are specifically for plant disease geeks like me. So you can see the bleeding heart that's on there, but the little kind of pinkish bars that are on there, that's actually a diagram of the virus.
Oh.
And the little gray wiggles that you see there are actually tiny nematodes. And this particular virus is moved from plant to plant by these little worm-like organisms that are in the soil. So those are the nematodes.
You had way too much fun with this, Brian.
I did have a lot of fun with this. Indeed, I did.
Well, let's talk about this tobacco rattle virus a little bit. We have it here in Wisconsin.
Yes.
And is it something that we have to worry about, or is it just going to make our plant look pretty?
On ornamentals, I don't worry about it that much.
Okay.
But the reason it's such an important virus is because it not only goes to ornamentals, but also potatoes. And we have a huge potato industry here in the state. We're the third largest producer of potatoes in the U.S. And once it gets into the potatoes, it doesn't really cause leaf symptoms like it does on bleeding heart, but it'll get into the tubers and it causes little bits of the tuber tissue to die. So you get these kind of brown flecks in the tubers. And if you're growing chipping potatoes for making potato chips, when you slice those up and fry those potatoes with these little necrotic areas, you get black spots in your potato chips, which is not a good selling point.
No, not at all. Next one, I liked the blossom end rot, which, of course, we get lots of questions about on
right.
Garden Talk. So let's have you read that limerick.
Yeah. A tomato ensconced in a pot was never once watered a lot. Its low calcium rate drove it into a state where it suffered from blossom end rot. And again, that gives you some information about the problem here. It's not really a true disease. It's a lack of calcium in the plant that causes that particular problem.
And
we see this on tomatoes and peppers and any vegetable crop where you're eating the actual fruit, botanical fruit of the crop can potentially have blossom end rot.
Mm-hmm. And is that caused by not watering or watering it infrequently or something like that, right?
Yeah, the you can have either too little calcium in the soil, which is not usually a problem here in Wisconsin. We mm-hmm. have limestone as our bedrock, so we have plenty of calcium typically. But usually, as the plants go into flowering and producing fruits, if you're not watering them enough, you can't mobilize enough of that calcium in the soil to get it into the plants and into the fruits. So we really recommend making sure you're giving your plants, your tomatoes, a lot of water as they start to flower.
Mm-hmm. And where can you get it real quick?
Yeah, you can go to my clinic website, which is pddc.wisc.edu. And if you just scroll down that main page, there's a series of tabs towards the bottom of the page. And one of them says Limerickettsia book. And you can open that up. It gives you a link to a description of the book. And then that links you to an order form. And all of the proceeds for the book are going to support my clinic on campus.
Which is wonderful. And we do have a link on our program note today. So you just go to WPR.org/Larry and you will see that under this particular program. We're talking with Brian Huddleston about his book, Limerickettsia, a plant pathologist book of verse. Brian is director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. And right now we are talking to Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. He has published a fun little book on plant disease. It's called Limerickettsia, a Plant Pathologist Book of Verse. So what's the response been to your fellow pathologist?
The pathologists, plant pathologists they interact, they like the book. Of course, they're going to because that's their thing. sales are certainly not hopping, let me put it that way, but that really wasn't the point. In part, the project is just trying to find alternate ways to get people excited about plant diseases. From a personal standpoint, my paternal grandmother was an author. She wrote a lot of kids' poetry and games and was an author on one book. So there was kind of an impetus there for me to try to do something in the same vein. So, but I'm happy it's out and have been distributing them as I can.
Sure. So. Well, it may not be a New York Times bestseller, but I'm sure it'll be a classic.
Yeah. Well, I hope so. And I hope people find it useful as a teaching tool.
Again,
my goal was not only to just write a book, but have it educational as well, because that's kind of what I do.
Yeah. And, it's really nice because it's a fun way to learn about things. It's not painful
right.
at all. So.
No.
And it's one of those things where, pick one a day and you learn about the disease
right.
and you have a good time.
Yeah.
So so let's talk about a few more of the limericks. What about the one on needle cast? That's 24.
Yeah. And I'll explain how I actually came up with that one.
Okay.
Another eccentricity of mine. The overused blue and white spruce formed innermost needles of puce. Once a short time had passed, all these needles were cast and the trees became landscape abuse. And that one actually originated because for some reason, I really like the word puce. And I have since I was a little kid. And so it's like, okay, I want to use this word. And it made sense in the context of this disease because with the needle cast, I'm talking about rhizosphere needle cast. It's a fungal disease and it causes interior needles on spruce trees to turn this kind of purple color. So puce really fit in. And then the landscape abuse is because it makes the trees look so ugly. It doesn't kill them, but makes them look ugly enough that you kind of wish they were dead. So that was, I think, apropos as well. So,
oh, that's great. Well,
and we really do overuse blue and white spruce in our landscapes. So
we do. We do. It's funny that you like the word puce, because I like puce and chartreuse. Those are two of my favorite color names. So appreciate that, Brian. And we've got a caller, Barb in Blue Mounds. What question do you have?
Hi, can you hear me?
We can. Go ahead.
All right, super. My husband and I are debating about no-till gardening. I lay hay down every year and notice that what it's doing is causing new soil to be generated that seems really good and fresh. Last year, the tomatoes did not do well. They didn't produce. They grew, but they were spindly. Question we have is whether or not we should go back through and turn the soil, because the idea is that you don't, my understanding is the idea is that you don't disrupt the biome that's developed there. So we don't really understand how to then go back in and work the soil if we need to.
Yeah, I would say that there is definitely some information indicating that you get kind of these networks of fungi that develop in the soil if you leave it as no-till. Really, though, in order to plant properly, you may have to do at least a little minimal cultivation to get the material incorporated into the soil. And from a plant disease standpoint, really, sometimes you can run into some problems with no-till because you're leaving a lot of plant debris on the surface, which can be a place where disease-causing organisms can overwinter, survive, and then they'll sit there, and a lot of the pathogens are fungi, so they'll generate spores in that debris that can eventually infect new plants that you're planting in the area. So there is some benefit from a disease standpoint of burying that debris to get it to rot really quickly. But again, I understand what I would suggest would be to, if you really want to get the benefits of the no-till, would be to just put in plants where you need to. So dig holes and put them in. And then you probably want to mulch over the top of that. That covers up the debris, the old plant debris that you've left. And that'll provide a physical barrier to help prevent some of the spore movement from that debris into the air where it can blow around and get to your plants.
Okay, thank you for the question, Barb. And I know that last year a lot of people did have problems with tomatoes. We got a lot of calls and garden talk. So maybe it's just a fluke.
Yeah,
it's hard to say.
For me, from a plant disease standpoint, we see problems with tomatoes every year. In fact, one of the other limericks that you tagged that you liked was on one of the most common diseases that we see on tomatoes. So,
Okay, well, thank you, Barb. Well, I think we probably should read that since you kind of, you know, got people interested on it now. Which one was that?
Yeah, so if you've ever had tomato plants that defoliate from the bottom up, this limerick is for you. And that's pretty much everyone who has ever grown a tomato plant.
Right.
And the limerick is, on tomato leaves bottom to top, do noodle-like spores slyly drop. The plant's health is soon breached by small spots ringed and bleached. A tsunami of blight that won't stop. And that's a disease called septorial leaf spot. It's very common in home gardens. And the fungus is everywhere in the environment. And it does produce these noodly-like spores and tends to infect at the bottom of the plant first, where it's a little bit wetter. Fungal pathogens really like wetter conditions. And it will cause a lot of spotting to the point where the entire leaf will collapse, and that'll kind of move up the plant. The saving grace to this particular disease is that it does not infect or affect the fruits. So you do get at least some usable fruits from the plants, but you can end up with plants that have basically no foliage by the end of the growing season. And that will really, of course, reduce yield, how many tomatoes you get and how big they are.
I've had plants like that.
Yeah, most gardeners are. And there's not a lot you can do for that disease. We have a fact sheet on my website that talks about things you can try to do. But if we have the right summer weather, if it's particularly wet, you can do everything I have listed on that fact sheet and you'll still have problems.
Yeah. So. I have a picture up on our program note with the, what is it? Oh, bird's nest of fungi.
Yeah.
Why don't you talk a little about that? You were talking about mulch before and you can find it in mulch. It's really kind of cool.
it's the coolest little organism and the name is very descriptive. It's not a disease-causing organism. And it's just a fungus that tends to colonize mulch layers.
It's on 80 if you're looking for it, I think.
Yeah,
79.
Thank you.
79.
78, yeah. Okay. And the name is so descriptive because it looks, you'll take a look at your mulch and you'll see these little tiny things that look like little bird's nests with eggs inside. And they're actually fungal structures. The eggs are actually packets of spores. And they are ejected from the cup by raindrops. And so those splash them out. And then this little packet of spores will have a sticky kind of tendril that's attached to it. And as they get ejected out, eventually that tendril will stick to, say, a plant or something like that. And it'll kind of wrap around like a bolo. And then eventually those packets break open and the spores are distributed that way. So it's a little bit elevated. So the spores are more likely to be picked up in air currents and moved around.
It's just amazing.
So it's incredibly beautiful little fungus that doesn't do any harm. So if you see it, just kind of look at it and be in awe because it's that's the fungus that's making that structure. And if you want me to, I'll read that.
Please do.
Because, it's when mulching with shredded oak bark, fungal oddity, you may remark, like a tiny wren's nest where within we eggs rest. Bird's nest fungus you've seen on a lark.
How big is that? It looks like it's pretty tiny.
The size is pretty accurate in the photo, so maybe about an inch across.
Okay,
so that's pretty similar.
Sure.
And they typically occur in clusters in the mulch, so you'll see more than one of those.
Okay, great. Well, something to look forward to seeing, I'm sure. Let's go back to the phones. We have Perry and Ocanto with a question. Hi, Perry.
Hello, and Brian, is there any diseases that you have to be mindful of red raspberry bushes? I had a great patch for about 15 years, and about the last three, they just slowly died out, and I don't know really what caused it.
The two diseases that I tend to see commonly on, well, the one disease I tend to see commonly on raspberries over time is Phytophthora root and crown rot. It's caused by a fungal, actually technically it's what's called a water mold, which is a fungus-like organism. It's a soil-borne organism. It produces these very long-lived resting spores, a very thick wall, so they can survive in the soil for years, if not decades. And when you're growing a plant in the same area year after year after year, you're eventually, if that organism is in the soil to start with, it could very well be, it's going to build up in terms of the amount of the organism, and then you're going to start to see your plants decline. And there's not much you can do about that other than to establish a new raspberry patch in a new location with new plants. Do not move plants from your old patch into that new area because you'll bring the pathogen with you. The other disease that I see, interestingly, I saw an example of this, and I don't see it very often, but if you ever see the tips of the branches of the canes dying back, and it looks like the infection is kind of centered around where the flowers were attached. It could be a disease called fire blight. We normally see that more commonly on apples and pears and crab apples, where it will cause a lot of branch dieback. But there's a special little variant of this bacterium that is specialized for causing the disease on raspberries. And that'll kind of cause them to kind of crook at the top, although not always, but oftentimes they will.
Okay, thank you very much, Perry. Let's do another, excuse me, limerick, Brian. Let's see, this one is 66, I believe.
Yeah,
it was kind of funny because I was reading this. I just read another book where a horse got into some bad rye and, outcome wasn't great. So anyway, talk about that one.
Yeah, so this is ergot, which is another fungal disease. We'll talk a little bit about the history. Let me read the limerick first.
Mm-hmm.
On grasses, especially rye, do maroon grains protrude by and by. Within these you'll find chems that alter the mind or with bad luck will cause you to die. And this fungus is notorious for, it infects the grain heads and invades the developing grains and converts them into a little resting structure called the sclerotium. And these are kind of dark purple in color. And the fungus actually does produce a variety of different, very interesting chemicals. Some of them are the precursors to LSD and can be quite toxic. There's some that can cause abortions, some that will cause circulatory problems, so that if you would eat this, you might eventually develop gangrene because you're not getting enough oxygen to your outer limbs. They can cause hallucinations, of course. The LSD-based ones will do that. And there's a really interesting history to this, because back in the Middle Ages, the primary grain that people were using to make bread was rye, and it's quite susceptible to this disease. So people would grow the grain, they'd have this ergot fungus in there, and they wouldn't recognize it. They'd grind up the grain into flour, bake it in the bread, and a lot of these chemicals produced by the ergot fungus aren't destroyed by heat. So they would have contaminated bread, and people would eat this and either go crazy, have hallucinations. If you eat enough of the material, it can kill you. And there were problems across medieval Europe, and the disease at that time in humans was called St. Anthony's Fire, based on the fact that one of the symptoms oftentimes was it would cause kind of a rosy discoloration to your cheeks. That was the fire. And then St. Anthony came from the fact that there was an order of monks, the Order of St. Anthony, said to set up hospitals throughout medieval Europe in order to treat people that had eaten this contaminated material. And there's some speculation that the Salem witch trials may have been due to ergot as well. They think some of the women who were accusing people of being witches and, you know, flying around may have eaten ergotized bread. And then there's some speculation that part of the reason Napoleon was not successful in invading Russia during the Napoleonic Wars was because as his army was invading Russia, it didn't help that they were doing this in the wintertime.
No.
But also, the Russians were destroying all their foodstuffs as they were retreating. And so the French army was eating off of materials they could forage off the land. And they were probably picking up grasses that were infected with the ergot fungus, and that was causing damage. And even into the 1950s, there was a little town in France called Pont-Saint-Esprit, and they got a bad batch of flour that was contaminated, baked it into bread, and they had several hundred people who suffered from ergotism because of that.
Wow, it's amazing. A teeny tiny little thing like that can cause
little
so much
fungus.
Problem. Yeah.
Interesting, though, nowadays, people will actually inoculate fields with ergot and collect the sclerotia and distill some of these chemicals from that, and they're used medicinally. So some of the chemicals, if you combine them with caffeine, you can help treat migraine headaches. Huh. Others, the ones that I mentioned that potentially can cause abortions, if you dilute those to very low concentration, if someone's having difficulty giving birth and you need to induce labor, they can be used to induce labor.
Wow, that is just amazing. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Mary and Monona with a question. Hi, Mary.
Hi. So I'm calling about my river birch trees. I have three of them that I planted about 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And they're all the same size, but one of them that's about 50 feet from the others is yellow. Its leaves are never really fully green. And although it continues to grow, should I worry about this tree or just let it go?
If you take a look at those yellow leaves, you're probably going to notice, if you inspect them really closely, that the leaves are yellow, but the veins are distinctly dark green. And that's a very typical characteristic of a disorder called chlorosis. And it's not a true disease. It's actually a nutrient deficiency. Typically in birch trees, it's an iron deficiency in the tree. And it's not usually that we don't have enough iron in our soils. We usually have plenty of iron, but that our soil pH is overly high, which again makes a lot of sense because our underlying bedrock is limestone, which tends to cause the soil pH to go very, very high. And that locks up nutrients like iron in the soil so that the trees can't take up that nutrient. And the fact that you have other trees in your landscape that are looking fine may simply indicate that locally underneath that one particular tree, you might have a limestone boulder, or maybe the bedrock is a little bit closer to the surface, so that's modifying the soil pH. So one of the things you could do is to get a soil test into the UW Soil and Forage Lab, have them test it for the soil pH, and also ask them to test for iron content, also manganese content. That's another nutrient that potentially can induce chlorosis if there's not enough of that in the plant. That's more common, though, in red maples rather than something like birch. But oftentimes the trees will grow perfectly fine, even though they're a little bit low on iron. We see this also on oaks. In particular, pin oak is not a tree that I typically recommend in southern Wisconsin because it has a lot of chlorosis problems. So it's very common. And I do have a limerick in my book on that particular disorder. So if you want to read a little bit more.
Yeah, we won't give it them all away. You'll have to get the
book. We won't give them all away. Yeah. But again, it's something you can potentially try to correct, but it's usually by attempting to adjust the soil pH, which can be a little bit difficult to do, but it is doable.
Okay, great. Thank you for that question, Mary. Did you have a favorite limerick in the book?
I have to say there are aspects of one. There's one that I won't read on the air. It's a little bit risque.
I know which one you're talking about, but it's very funny.
But I won't read that one. But the other ones that I think I really like, there are two of them, actually. I like the one on fairy rings, and then there's also one on grain rusts that I find kind of amusing.
Okay.
So,
You can read one of those if you want.
Yeah, let's do the grain rust one, because that has some historical interesting facts to it. The Romans of old put their trust in a god who personified rust. To gain his goodwill, a red dog would they kill, so their grain harvest wasn't a bust. And there actually is a Roman god of grain rust and other agricultural diseases. He's called Robagus or Robaga, depending upon the source information that you read. And there was actually a Roman festival called Robigalia. It just was not that long ago, April 25th, mark it on your calendar.
Next year.
next year is Robigalia. And they would have a festival, usually a lot of feasting, chariot races. And then, as the limerick implies, they would sacrifice red-haired dogs to Robigus to kind of ensure that their grain harvest was good that year. And so I tell folks that, you know, you should celebrate Robigalia, but don't sacrifice dogs. I'm not advocating that. If you really want to kind of combine the dog sacrifice and the feasting, I suggest eating hot dogs.
Good. They're kind of red.
Dogs. They're kind of red, sort of. And you get the feasting in there as well. And you know, I'm not a big fan of hot dogs, so kind of sacrificing them to get them off the face of the earth is probably a good thing in my mind. We've gotten our graduate students into doing this, and they had like egg races when they did it. They just had a get together and they had hot dogs.
I love it.
Yeah.
There'll be cards next year, probably.
That's right. Well, I should design some, I suppose.
Well, there you go. Like this.
I could do that. I actually have taken the artwork and pulled that out, and I'm planning on trying to make ceramic tiles with the artwork,
which I'm hoping will be
kind of interesting.
Very much so. Well, time is winding down here, but do you have any advice for people who are trying to write their own limericks?
Just go for it. Don't be bashful about looking online or finding rhyming dictionaries or a thesaurus. I learned that from an interview by Diane Sawyer of Stephen Sondheim years ago, when she was asking him how he came up with his lyrics and found all these rhymes. And his comment was, "Do you think this just comes out of my head? No, I use rhyming dictionaries and a thesaurus." So, and then just get the patter down. And once you get the patter down and understand the kind of the rhythm of limericks, they're not that difficult to write.
Okay. Well, Stephen Sondheim said it's okay to do that.
It's okay.
Brian, thank you so much for being with us.
Welcome.
And
thank you for having me.
You bet. Thanks for writing this book. It's so much fun. We've been talking with Brian Huddleston about his book, Limerexia, a Plant Pathologist Book of Verse. Brian is director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Stay well. You know, buying seeds can get expensive, so you want to make sure you know how to get good quality seeds. Or maybe you'd like to save your own. Well, we'll help you out with both of those options today. I'm Jill Nadeau, and this is Garden Talk. Our next guest is Clint Freund. He is co-owner of Cultivating the Commons, a seed growing company based in Amory, Wisconsin. And we'll talk with him about seed saving, heirloom seeds, and more. And we'll take your questions and comments. And just for those who were listening earlier, that was pre-recorded. Right now, we are live. So we can take your calls. And the number is 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Clint, thank you so much for being with us today.
Yes, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. I bet you're kind of enjoying the colder weather because you have kind of a break. Maybe?
Sort of. We segue quickly into seed testing, seed cleaning, all those sort of things from the season. So there is a little bit of a lull sometime in July where all the seeds are doing the thing. And then we start cranking again into the fall. And then, yeah, it just gradually transitions into more indoor work, sitting at tables, counting to 100 over and over and over again. As I test all the seeds to make sure they're doing good.
Yeah, that's going to kind of drive you crazy a little bit, doesn't it? I mean, or do you have to be a special kind of person to be able to do that?
Oh, I studied music, and I just put on lots of different music and go on adventures through all that while I'm counting.
Yes, and to time, right? So you're going to be doing a cut time for the seeds.
You got it, yeah.
I love it. Well, tell us how you got into the seed growing business.
Sure. I started off on a dairy farm, actually just across from the Horicon Marsh. I think an earlier chat was about the Horicon Marsh that I heard. Grew up on a dairy farm, loved it. Ended up going into music. All of us kind of went to different humanities. But after I finished that degree, just kind of met a crossroads. Didn't want to sit in front of computers, et cetera, et cetera. A friend saved me and introduced me to some of my favorite mentors, Beth Pincus and Steve Kazmar. They run TB Produce outside of Madison, Wisconsin. Spent almost 8 years cutting my teeth, didn't know what kale was, loved it, and just kept going farther and farther down the wormhole. And also I got to the end of, I found out I wanted to know where seed came from. I saw these packets on the table and just kind of questioned who these corporations were or these people making the seed. And suddenly I wanted to find someone that grew seed and maybe I'll try some of my own. And I had little gardens. Tried it out, was completely in awe of the onion flower. And then I did find some mentors I was able to apprentice with, Beth and Nathan Corum. They live out in western Nebraska, so out in the dry land. Spent 2 years studying every type of kind of garden vegetable you could grow for seed. But definitely knew I had to get back to Wisconsin. I love this land base. I love being in the upper Midwest here. So trying to bring those skills back with me. And kind of started this business as a way to take that to the next level.
And it's hard work, right? I would assume it's not something that it's 9 to 5, 5 days a week.
Yes, it's all encompassing for sure. Yeah, the plants, it's a different level. Once you learn how to grow the vegetable, growing the seed is another next level to just figure out and wrap your head around when's the right time to harvest, make sure you're shooting the windows correctly, make sure you're drying it down properly, maybe avoiding disease issues, all those different selection-oriented things. It takes a lot of people and friends. Cassandra McKinnon was key in moving back with me and helping start this business and continues to provide support as we develop the next spot.
Yeah, that was one of my next questions is how many people do you need to make this business successful?
For the most part, it's just us on a small farmstead. Right now, we collaboratively farm with some neighbors, Whetstone Farm and Amory. We both do vegetable-oriented things, and they also have a grazing business. And then we have lots of cohorts in the seed business realm. A lot of people have helped me along the way, including the Experimental Farm Network, Nature Nurture Seeds. You'll find there's an explosion of small bioregional seed companies out there since the early teens or aughts in 2000s. I think there's a lot of interest in exploring bioregional seed and small seed companies being able to offer their product through online websites and things like that.
What are the advantages of having bioregional seed?
One of the key advantages is growing often most of these seed companies, a lot of big seed companies are often growing seed grown from all across the world. And it's often a shell game as to where that seed came from. They obviously had superior breeding techniques from across the world in different ways. Bioregionalism focuses on growing seed in situ, saving seed from the environment it was grown in, and that, you know, excelled or did great in those spots. So when I look at my row of broccoli plants, I pick out, you know, the ones that are doing the best or showing the best traits that I want, you know, either productivity or disease resistance. And then you select from there and continue that into the future with every selection. So usually companies that focus on that trait to kind of sell, you know, focus on that. Let's see here. That's about it. We also focus on our certified organic practices. So a lot of our stuff's put through that gauntlet of more like organic matter oriented field situations. You know, we don't use a ton of pesticides, maybe one little BT oriented thing, but otherwise we try to make the plant look, you know, select for resilience. And
So as a gardener, we would definitely want to seek out seeds that were growing in the area where we want to plant them, right?
Totally. Absolutely. One of the big projects I'm working on right now through a grant is growing out a very diverse broccoli strain. The goal is of the grant is to grow as many varieties together to make this explosion of diversity from which growers and home gardeners can select their favorite plants out of that do best in their soil types, their short season or long season or hot season or this or that. And so that'll be a 3-year project over the next few years where we combine, recombine, you know, crisscross and cross all these different varieties to make this really interesting family of plants that home gardeners can do that selection.
So you've become quite the scientist then throughout this work.
Yeah, it is kind of a citizen scientist. I feel like a jack of all trades in that realm where I learn and have a distinct interest, but not a distinct, you know, doctorate or anything in it. But I have a lot of excitement and enthusiasm for it.
And hands-on helps a great deal too, I would assume.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, your business is called Cultivating the Commons. Now, where did that name come from?
Initially my thought was that I noticed a lot of seeds were hybrids or they had utility patents or things that kind of guarded the genetics. And you'll find that, you know, either F1s aren't inherently bad, but they do hide their genetics and you can't save their seed easily. A lot of utility patents tend to block people from saving the seed or from researchers or breeders or what have you from using those traits in their programs or in their gardens. And the goal of the commons was something we all have in common, we share. So the genetic diversity that is something we've inherited as a civilization or a group of humans on this planet from everyone before us is kind of what we all have in common. And I was excited to maybe run a business around that ethos of cultivating that together, cultivating these genetics that have been passed down to us.
Okay. And how does community itself play into your company?
In several ways. We offer classes, we do workshops, we do tours on the farm. My ultimate goal was to eventually land somewhere with enough farmers nearby or people that would be at the forefront of the plants, you know, providing food for people, also selecting cultivars they really enjoy. It's easy to see a dependency in farming. There's so many parameters to control, and often seed is a really difficult one to dance with. And you kind of just go with trusted catalogs or this or that. And stick with that. And I totally respect that. But they also have a key knowledge about how to pick out those select cultivars or we, you know, develop new varieties of this or that. So I was excited to maybe get in a region that had more small farmers that had the capacity or interest in developing and selecting together and offering seed through an entity or a group. We're getting there. It takes time though to develop relationships and things like that. And also to train people. So bit by bit.
Sure. We did get a call from Damien in Rib Lake. He couldn't stay with us, but he grows plants in a greenhouse and wants to be able to transition the greenhouse seeds into a field. What does he need to know about doing that?
I believe he's talking about transplanting greenhouse transplants into the garden.
I think so. That's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah. Not particular about seed saving, but a very simple technique is when you're growing indoor plants in your greenhouses, you have to expose them gradually. So as soon as they're big enough, You know, they're in trays, they're big enough and green and lush, and they're ready to head outside, and you don't want to put them in the ground right away. You wait, you give them a couple, at least a week to expose them to UV rays and wind and temperature switches and stuff like that. So it hardens their cell walls and makes them nice and sturdy and ready to go into the ground. So I always wait at least 1 week.
At least a week, yeah. Yeah. And do you put them in a shady area first and then transition out to the sun, or sun first?
Oh, no, I usually expose them, yeah, okay. Right away. Mm-hmm. Keep them watered, maybe drought them a little bit. But, yeah, usually I'll seed stuff into trays, overseed it usually. And then in my selection process as a seed grower, I'm culling and in the flat these little seedlings that don't seem as strong as the others. So I have my strongest selected, you know, individuals going out into the field. And then they get more selections after I transplant, you know. Whoever's the strongest made it to the field will then get selected there for either productivity or just vigor in face of the potato beetle or something, you know.
Sure. Lots of observation, I would assume.
Lots of it, yeah.
Do you take lots of copious notes, or is this stuff you keep in your head?
It's a lot in the head. I do try to – now with phones, it's so easy to take pictures and keep up with some things. And so I do try to take – I'm a visual person, so – that's usually very helpful. But otherwise, a lot of intuition and, you know, 8 years at a large scale farm and then another 8 years doing small scale, you develop a lot of eye for things.
Certainly, certainly. So what do you do with all the seeds that you do grow? Where do they go?
Okay. Yeah. Well, we started off in my apprenticeship growing for their small seed company, and then they did lots of growing for regional or national companies. So at the moment, I got introduced to growing wholesale. So I'll grow a huge area of, say, I don't know, a little popcorn. And that maybe I'll harvest 400 pounds or whatever of that. And then that gets shipped to another company, and then they repackage it and disperse that to customers. So a lot of our seed is collected. A bulk of our income comes from growing for companies like Seed Savers Exchange. Let's see here. Southern Exposure Seed Exchange, Baker's Creek Heirlooms, if you've heard of them.
Yeah, we talk to Jer almost every year. So,
Yeah. We've been growing tomatoes and peppers for them. So we might grow upwards of 10 pounds of tomato seed. That could be a big swath of an area. And we'll just harvest tomatoes just for the seed. Harvest that. Everything gets cleaned, dried down, packaged and sent out. And then I usually have a lot of little secondary other stuff for our small seed company. So I do a lot of seed sales through our small online account. And we meet area greenhouses. Sometimes we put seed racks in as another way to obtain seed we grow. But yeah, other companies. And then we smell through a lot of small ones like the Experimental Farm Network or So True Seeds out of Virginia, North Circle Seeds out of Minnesota here. There's a lot. Probably upwards of 10 different companies we work with and distribute our seed through.
So there's a lot of networking, I'm assuming, that goes on with this, with you, the smaller seed companies. Is there information out there? Where would you recommend someone go who's maybe interested in growing some seed for sale?
Well, most of my associations are through the Organic Seed Alliance. They're a large nonprofit on the West Coast. They actually have a conference coming up this spring in February or in winter. But you can visit their website, and they have a wholesale, they have a whole listing of all organic, small, you know, big and small seed companies throughout the U.S. And you can probably search for smaller companies through their listing. Otherwise, a lot of small seed companies tend to be very convivial about sharing other companies out there. And you can visit some of the ones I listed, and they'll have links to other people in the region.
Sure. So what are some of the varieties that you grow for sale?
Oh, gosh, man. I was just going through it last night. The other night, because I'm like, yeah, I got to finish my testing here so we can offer, have everything ready to be offered. You know, I think we offer over 130 different varieties.
Wow.
And it mostly comes from just purely our experiences. So it isn't like we haven't done hundreds of trials. It's mostly from what's worked from us. Working at farms, what I've seen farmers enjoy, or what I'm amazed by or excited to offer people that maybe they can't have, it isn't being offered currently. So our offering is very mixed and diversified, but usually works really well in the upper Midwest. It's most functional in this climate. But I ship stuff all the way down to Alabama, to San Diego, the coasts, There's people. It's amazing what the algorithm will help point people towards.
Excellent.
Even small little hole-in-the-wall companies like this. Yeah.
I love it. We're talking about growing and saving seeds with Clint Freund. He's the co-owner of Cultivating the Commons, and we'll be back to talk more about it right after this little bit of news. Welcome back to Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, and we're talking about growing and saving seeds with Clint Freund. He's co-owner of Cultivating the Commons, a seed-growing company based in Amory, Wisconsin. What questions do you have about saving seeds? Do you need some advice on how to select good seeds? Well, join in by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. So, Clint, I noticed on your website that you're part of the Open Source Seed Initiative. Why don't you talk a little bit about what that is and why it's important to you?
Sure. The Open Source Seed Initiative was started a little bit back. I kind of alluded to some of the dilemmas people were facing with either hybrid or utility patents issues in breeding, saving seed, this and that. OSSI was developed in Wisconsin and amongst some other states and developers. They were developing a concept around kind of open source technology, wherein the code and stuff is open and for use. It's kind of patented left, copy left or whatever, in essence, and free to use and be developed upon. And so the OSSI was developed as a place where people, gardeners, breeders could submit varieties that they've developed and want to keep in for public use. And usually all those varieties have a little subheader. I could bring it up, but you know, usually it restricts privatizing the genetics or traits therein for that variety and promotes continue to be used thereafter. If you're seed saving it or offering it to other places, that you offer the same rights of the seed to be shared, to be used for breeding and other such things. I have a few varieties I offer. A lot of companies they've tried to develop their own varieties and offer it through it. I think some of them are great and they're really vigorous and well-bred by these people, and we'd like to continue that program and see where it goes.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Now, let's go to the actual growing the seeds itself.
Yeah,
how,
sure.
Is it different than growing for, say, produce? Because most people grow a tomato to sell the tomato, not the seeds. So.
Correct. So I think there's a lot of steps. No, there's not a lot. Okay, let me retract. There's not a lot of steps. I usually have my first three things I tell people: keep it simple, keep it interesting, and then just do that little modicum of research. You'll find growing the vegetable is definitely one thing. And then often there's a few more steps for the seed. Sometimes it'll surprise you, sometimes it won't. But usually there's four steps for me, what I teach people. One is you have to find the open pollinated seed. So you have to first define that, and that just generally means seed that's able to be saved, and their offspring will look like the parents. So when we're looking for open pollinated, generally anything that's heirloom or in that vein of thought, you know, either it's labeled open pollinated or it's just simply not labeled hybrid. Hybrid is a breeding process wherein they use inbred parents, and when you save the seed from those offspring of them, you tend up getting mixed up traits that aren't quite what you're looking for or hoping for. And it could take years of segregating and sorting to get the variety you want, which is an adventure that some people do. For the home gardener, sticking with open pollinated heirloom is great. The next thing you'd have to know is if it's annual or biennial. Does it make seed the first year or does it make seed a second year? Is this going to be a longer adventure or a short one? And for new gardeners or new seed savers, I recommend annuals. Often, you'll do a little research and you'll find out, oh, it grows seed in 1 year, like the tomato. Very easy. There it is. You have ripe fruit ready to harvest the seed from and make a sandwich. Other plants like eggplant, you're going to let the plant go as far as possible to ripeness. You will not want to eat it by the time the seed is ripe. And you got to let it sit on the plant all season long. So I usually recommend people visiting seedsavers.org/learn. And they have a resource for every species you can imagine in the garden. And you can find out the little steps you'll need to take to see that seed saving through. But yeah, I can take questions today, too, if you have specific crops you'd like to talk
about.
Sure.
Wonderful. Well, we do have a caller. Not quite about that, but something else. Ron in La Crosse, go right ahead.
Yes. My question is, I have a vacuum sealer. It's a type of thing where you can preserve food, nice, boldly, vegetables, in a special bag, or you can suction air out of a mason jar, you know, with a lid to prolong the viability of foods and things. If a person were to vacuum seal, say, any type of seed in a special bag for this vacuum sealer, is you think that taking the air out would help prolong the viability of seeds?
Oh, for sure. So definitely when saving seed, I recommend getting your seed as dry as possible. You harvest from the field. You spent all season growing it. You bring it in. You let it dry completely, and then you thresh and clean it. And that usually just means getting some of the chaff off before you put it away for storage. After things are nice and dry, like seed should crunch or snap. There should be no flexibility in the seed. That's when you know it's getting very close to dry. In my undertaking and practice, my mentors are always like, paper is forgiving. And they always said that because in the past they put things in the plastic or this or that, and it might have been too early. And I've already seen this professionally. People put things in the plastic and then they mold because they're a little too moist yet. And so I often like to let things sit, you know, in a dry area through the winter. And then maybe in spring I'll package them into plastic. Plastic being the next step up. What you're trying to do is separate the seed from humidity, which can help deteriorate its longevity. Temperature fluctuations are a big thing as well. So you want to keep a even, cool, dry area. For storing, yeah, paper's okay. It helps dehesc the seed, or, you know, it helps dry the seed out. But then, you know, plastic's great, or thicker mill plastic's great. Jars or glass is ultimately the best. And as separating oxygen from the process, I haven't tried it, but I could see that working out pretty well. People do, to extend the life of their seed, package it and put it away into freezers. So once it's ultimately very dry and won't get any frost damage when you freeze it, you can put it in the freezer. And I recommend people just putting them into little packages in a bigger package so you can just pull out one at a time as you need them every season. I personally go through seed quite a bit, so I don't have a lot of experience around freezing, but we do utilize it to kill bugs sometimes if there is bugs in the seed lot. But I think vacuum sealing probably is not a bad option.
Do some experimentation, Ron. Make sure you wait.
Yeah, always. Before you package anything, my strongest thing is make sure your seed is good and crisp, good and dry.
Good and dry. Because it can be very deceiving, can it, to looking at a seed. So do you have buildings, I'm assuming, that you use for this?
Yes. So a lot of the crops that we're used to are very Eurocentric. They're often Mediterranean-esque. You know, broccolis or this or that, and they're used to dry climates of the coastals. So growing up for seed in the Midwest requires a lot of hoops to jump. Certain crops do well outside. Some I do grow undercover. Maybe the first year I grow outside, and then the second year when I make seed, I'll grow them in hoop house culture. I'll harvest the dry pods, let them finish on tarps undercover or in sheds, and then we thresh, separate the seed from the chaff. And then after that, they get put into basically paper bags until there's finer cleaning. Trying to remember what the beginning of your question was there.
Oh, that was so long ago.
Stories. We have lots of buildings. We often let things cure under sheds or awnings and stuff, mm-hmm, or under tarps so they can finish in the sun. Crops move pretty quickly once they start drying down.
Mm-hmm. Do you have to utilize like a drying dryers, I guess, is what I'm thinking.
No, we don't use too many dryers. Usually the climate's been good enough to allow that. And usually our hoop house culture for some of these dry seeded crops is good to do in.
Okay.
I recommend people at home to just hang them in their garage,
mm-hmm.
either keep them on a tarp, make sure there's not too many pests around. I know lots of people will bring something in and then have mice scurry quickly to them. So don't forget to put a trap out. And that's the recommendation there. But yeah, usually I let things just sit out of the rain as much as you can or off the humidity of the grass.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. Now, we've been talking about, I'm tossing around some of these terms, heirloom. There's also new loom. And of course, then there's hybrid seed. Can we talk a little bit about the difference between those?
Sure. New loom, I just throw out there for fun because it's, gosh, I think with these small seed companies, there's just a little explosion going on of possibility for new varieties or new species, or just new fun new plants to play with, right? So mm-hmm. a lot of companies are always breeding new stuff to put out there, but all these small companies have their opportunity now and a platform through their business or associative businesses to like offer these different varieties. And so I often call them new looms, soon to be heirlooms. I think heirloom, I think, is defined as, I think there's a definition of it, but it's an open pollinated plant that generally has a cultural history extending back maybe 80 to 100 years thereabout. So it's been something passed down from generation to generation, maybe through a particular culture or people. It's been maintained that way. Now, a lot, plants have a very similar tendency to narrow their genetics, and heirlooms tend to be very narrow. And although I do encourage exploring heirlooms and things, I also encourage exploring a lot of new looms or genetically diverse things, the things that have more genetic traits that maybe had been lost through the heirloom process.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think people are opening them, heirlooms aren't the only thing to grab. There's a lot of different new varieties out there to play with and see, and people are experimenting with breeding and seed saving. So I think it's a wonderfully diverse world out there to explore now.
Great. We're talking about growing and saving seeds with Clint Freund. He's co-owner of Cultivating the Commons, a seed growing company based in Amory. Join in by calling 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Stay with us because coming up in the last half hour of the show, we'll help you grow lavender with tips from lavender farmers Kathy and Randy Meyer of Potter Creek Lavender in Pulaski. Right now, we are talking about saving seed, using seed, and all that good stuff. So I was looking at your website, like I said, Clint, and I see that you actually have learning opportunities. So how do folks get involved with internships?
Certainly. People can apply, reach to us online if they live in the area or want to put in a day a week. We welcome folks to the farm. We have also have other opportunities, like we do tours, annual tours in July, where you call our bloom tour, where you can view and take in all the different seeds you've bought or like in their flowering states, everything from carrots to tomatoes to onions, you name it, all sorts of stuff looks great. We also offer workshops across the area up in the region here, including a couple this year. We'll have listed on our Facebook as well as website. Most of them are in Minnesota, but one is the Women's Environmental Institute on March 22nd. We'll be offering a class at that. We also go to seed swaps in the area, including the Kelly Farm Seed Swap on March 8th. And there is also a Traditional and Green Skills event in Prairie Farm, Wisconsin on the 8th as well, that we try to support or attend if we can.
Are those events listed on your website?
They will be soon. Most of our stuff is plugged away on Instagram or Facebook, but you can find us in those spots most active.
Yeah, and just to make sure you all know, it's Cultivating the Commons. Your website is ctcseeds, right? .com?
Yep.
So ctcseeds.com, so you can find it.
Anyone listening that logs in and is able to make a purchase, we have a little, you type in Garden Talk, all caps, and you can get a little percent off your sale.
Oh, nice. We like deals.
Stop on by. Thanks so much for listening.
Oh, sure. So tell us about this broccoli thing you're talking about earlier. A little bit more detail. This sounds really interesting.
Absolutely. I've been following a person named Joseph Lofthouse out of Utah. He's a kind of a renegade farmer or something, what you would call. He kind of went back to his family's land, started farming again, growing mostly garden vegetables for market gardens or markets in the area, but finding a lot of seed insufficient to his needs. He has a high elevation, short season climate, cold. So he started, he has a background in plants, but he started breeding what was called land races, basically highly diverse populations of different like species. So one I noted was melons. You know, a melon just couldn't even make a ripe fruit up there. So he grew out 10 different varieties. You know, 90% of it died. Three made some sort of fruit he could save seed of. The next year he took that seed, all mixed up, threw it back in the field, had a better like 50%. And next year it was even better. 90% had made fruit. It was successful. It was tasty. And it was even showing genetics from things that didn't survive that first round, but had passed on to other plants, their genetics. Mm-hmm. He saw a trait for this large, heavily ribbed type. And so he knew that there was a lot of crossing going on, and that was something to explore there and developing these highly diverse genetic populations for doing selections and finding something that does well in your climate, your situation. Out of that came this nonprofit called Going to Seed. They're based, I believe, in California. They've been offering grants to farmers to do on-farm breeding and programs around that same philosophy of creating these highly diverse populations. And just farming in the area, there's a lot of different things you can complain about as a farmer in terms of disease or this or that. But broccoli is just always this resounding one. Everyone just laments losing 50% of their broccoli to alternaria or some crown rot or this or that as large-scale growers. And even gardeners, you know, can suffer the same stuff. But I thought sprouting broccoli was always going to be a solution maybe to these, like, if we're so used to crown heads, big heads that just don't function in this climate well, maybe we need to focus on something else. And maybe we need something more interesting, diverse to select from. And so I just proposed a plan and they accepted it. And so we'll probably spend the next 2 to 3 years crossing, recrossing, and crisscrossing a lot of different varieties. We pull a lot of varieties from the USDA seed bank. USDA has a large seed bank anyone can access and acquire a little packet of different things that have been discovered and brought back to our seed bank. So we had a lot of things from Italy or China or these different things we put into the garden, you know, 10 of each. They're all allowed to flower together if they did flower. And then we collected the seed at the end of the season. And then they'll go on to next year and make another round. And we'll probably introduce, hopefully, another 10 to 15 different varieties we can drum up from either home gardeners or companies across the U.S. or across this, you know, the world, really. I would be interested in any. If you have a broccoli, contact me.
There you go.
We'd love to grow it.
So it's kind of like a survival of the fittest kind of a thing?
In essence. And I think survival of the fittest. And, you know, one of the goals is having that crossing, whether it was fit or not. Maybe it didn't have a great particular trait for this thing, but it did have really nice, you know, branching or this or that, and it mm-hmm. might pass on useful traits to the population. And then we leave the traits we don't want behind. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully the crisscrossing is the crucial part, not just 1 year, but usually up to 3 years of crisscrossing. I'll create these stacked and dense populations of mm-hmm. different things.
So when are you hoping to have a final outcome?
right. And yeah, seed saving can be a very long affair. It's good that you have patience and
yes
and you're very excited about it. I'm pretty excited about broccoli, so I know our goal was 3 years, and I think we have funding for two now, and we'll see how three comes along. But you can take a sneak peek. We are offering last year's seed from the process, and so you can play with it in your garden and see how it works or what mm-hmm. it looks like. I'd be curious to know. I haven't even grown it yet, so this will be fun to see this next year.
For sure. So what do you grow the most of on your farm?
Oh gosh. You know, tomatoes do really well in our climate. Mm-hmm. So we grow a ton of tomatoes. We'll be growing, I don't know, maybe a couple thousand pepper plants of this one variety for another seed company. So that's exciting. We do grow a lot of garlic. We sell through a couple different companies, like as seed quality. So that takes up a lot of room. Mm-hmm. But we grow, all sorts of things. I mean, usually there's probably 80 different things in the garden that we'll probably try to save the seed of, or at least observing and watching.
Sure, sure. So what about coming up in 2025? Do you have some new varieties that you're excited about selling?
There is one I think we'll be offering through Seed Savers Exchange called Cochran's Old Time. They haven't offered it from there, and they kind of brought it up from their seed banks, and they're excited to offer it. So we'll be growing out the seed of that variety of onion. I think it's from Cochrane, Wisconsin. Oh. It's kind of a Florence type, I would describe it as. More mm-hmm. of like an elongated red type that kind of has a variation of color. Really beautiful onion. Let's see here. What else are we excited about? There's a new cabbage I'm excited to see make seed called Red Flame. It's kind of a more crunchy, fresh eating red type that's got a, like more like pink. It's a new thing. Usually there's red or green, but now a lot of new varieties that are coming out have a nice dashing of color, either purple veins. So this one's got a nice pink with darker colors going on and mm-hmm. light colors. So that'll be really fun to watch make seed and offer that.
Yeah, for sure. So any like last words for people who want to start saving some seeds, maybe some do's and don'ts?
Sure. Yep. Keep it simple. Keep it interesting. My mentors are like, if you're saving seed and you're going to that work, you better love eating it. So, you know, pick your most thing you're excited about. Uh-huh. And usually for a beginning, I usually tell them to pick annuals that are, you know, don't require crossing or anything. So tomatoes, peas, and beans are a great place to start. Mm-hmm. And then visit your local seed swaps. You know, look them up. Look up seed swaps in Wisconsin. I'm sure you'll find some in the region nearby. I know the Oshkosh Valley, Fox Valley has a few that they do. And there's some in southern Wisconsin and some in northern Wisconsin. So, yeah.
Okay, great. And your website again?
That's www.ctcseeds.com. Okay. Ctseeds.com.
And you're on Facebook and Instagram?
Yeah.
Okay. And you can see some really nice pictures on the website and on that social media. So you can see a little bit about what's going on. And if people can just, if they want to take a tour, they can contact you on one of those.
Yeah. It's a very open farm policy. Please send a message. And if you're swinging through the area, we're more than happy to take time to show people around.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Clint. We really appreciate you taking the time and
thank you.
Get back to counting those seeds. Our guest has been Clint Freund. He's co-owner of Cultivating the Commons, a seed company based in Amory, Wisconsin. Coming up next, we'll be talking about growing lavender. Join in with your questions or comments by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, the lavender plant is associated with hot, dry Mediterranean weather. So can you grow it in Wisconsin? You bet you can. This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Our guests are Kathy and Randy Meyer of Potter Creek Lavender in Pulaski. We're going to ask them about their business and how to select and grow the best lavender varieties for our climate. Have you had problems growing lavender? What questions do you have for them? Join the conversation, the number 800-642-1234, or you can always send an email to talk@wpr.org. Kathy, Randy, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Jill.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks again. This is probably not a real busy time for you all in the lavender patch.
Nope, they're that sleeping.
They're sleeping. I love it. I love it. So, Kathy, tell us how Potter Creek Lavender got started.
Well, it is a long story. I'll try to make it pretty brief. We visited our daughter out when she lived in Washington and accidentally happened upon lavender farms and fell in love with them and decided maybe we could see if we could do that in Wisconsin. And there we are.
Well, that was a very short version for sure. So, Randy, what did you think when Kathy came to you and said, hey, let's grow lavender?
Well, I'm kind of more of the research individual.
And
so when she said that, I said, well, let's take a look here and see what's out there and see what we can do. And actually, there was a wonderful research study that came out of Ontario, Canada, who has a very similar climate to what we have. And they studied like 30 different lavenders during the cold time, and they graded how well they did. And we took some of that information, and that's what we really kind of started with. the varieties that they had documented that seemed to do best in the cold climates.
And that is the key, isn't it? I think we get a lot of calls from people who say, what can I do to get my lavender to grow? And it does boil down to the varieties, doesn't it, Kathy?
Oh, yes, definitely. You have to make sure for a zone that you live in. Like, in Wisconsin has different zones, so mm-hmm. you have to really... And we've had pretty good luck with the ones that are hardy for zone 5 to 9. Some of those, maybe not, but most of them have did really well.
And
we're in County, Brown County, right on the bay.
Sure, that makes a difference too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, Randy, you're not a farmer. Kathy, you're not either. Why did you think you could be successful? What possessed you?
Well, my love of plants. And I like to play in the dirt. So that mm-hmm. helps.
Okay. What about you, Randy?
I just kind of tag along with her.
She does what I said. So,
nice. Yeah, I like that.
Actually, we have our strong points on different ends of the scale. And working together works very well from that standpoint. And, you know, based on this, we were like, well, let's give this a try and kind of go from there. You know, Kathy had mentioned about, you know, the zones and the different varieties. What we recommend is having different varieties of lavender that you plant, because some winters, all the winters are very different. And what you want to do is make sure you got a couple different varieties at least, because one winter may affect one of those varieties and the others will do better, and vice versa the next year.
Mm-hmm.
So we recommend having, you know, different varieties, not going all in on just one specific variety.
Yeah.
Don't put all your eggs in one basket philosophy, which is always good. So how many varieties do you have now?
We have 12.
Oh, that's a lot. I mean, I know there's a lot of them out there, but 12 is good.
We have a smaller farm. There's some bigger ones in Wisconsin, definitely. We keep it about 1,200 just to keep it manageable for just a few of us that help here.
Mm-hmm. So how has your farm grown over the years? You actually obviously had to start somewhere. How did you do that? And what does it look like now?
So we looked for land in the sun because we were living in the woods. and we wanted to make sure the soil was good. And so we tested the soil before we bought the place, just so we wouldn't have to mend it too much. And it was perfect. So we have our land in the sun, and we experimented. We started with 200 plants in 2017, and then the next year they did well. So we added 500 more, and every year, every other, we'd add a couple hundred more. Yeah, that's how we got to our 1,200 right now.
That's what I've heard doing some research on lavender farms, is that it starts fairly small and then it just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah, you want to try, oh, this color, this would be nice, or let's try, you know, they're all so many different varieties of lavender. That's one thing people are surprised at. Like, oh, I didn't know there were more than 450, you know, types of lavender.
Right. And they vary by color and scent too, don't they?
Yes, and size, different stem lengths, different colors, and the scent, definitely. Each one of ours smells different.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty, very cool.
So what do people see when they come to your place now? I mean, not now, in as far as, like, it's wintertime. Yeah. I mean, now that you've got
like
to this
July.
Place in your business, right?
In July, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's very pretty. The field is beautiful. Very serene. And we have a little, like, pop-up area where we sell handcrafted products that we make and cut flowers. All the different...
When individuals come here, they go to our website, info@PotterCreekLavender.com, and they can set up an appointment, and July is the best time to come and visit. And if they want, we'll go and kind of give them a kind of a little rundown of all the different varieties we have, and we'll actually go and cut them and let them smell the differences in them, and you know, ask them to kind of pick out their favorites and those type of things. So we kind of make it interactive rather than just having them wander around on their own if they want that.
Do you need an appointment, or do you need, you have open hours?
Yeah, we usually schedule them. We want them to schedule with an appointment, if at all possible. If they show up, that's more than fine. But the appointments make it a little bit more manageable for Kathy and I, because we limit the number that are here at any one given time, so that gives us the opportunity to spend more time with everybody that comes.
Sure, that makes total sense. Do you have something to add, Kathy?
I was just going to say, yeah, we do have pop-ins, and that's fine. It works. We always make it work.
So let's talk about lavender growing resources. Now, you said you saw this study from Canada, but were there some other areas where you go to find out more about the lavender growing business?
Yes. If someone really wants to get into it, we recommend joining the USGLA. That's the United States Growers Lavender Association. You just get so much input. You can ask anything, and you get a lot of people responding, you know, from around the country. And there's a lot of lavender farms in the Midwest now, in Michigan and Wisconsin, Ohio. So a lot of similar temperatures. And the book I really love is The Lavender Lover's Handbook by Sarah Behringer Bader. Very good. Lots of information that I've used.
Oh, that's good to know, because there are a number of lavender growing books out there. And
that's my favorite.
Sure. Not many that pertain to growing in cooler climates, though, I would assume.
No, this one covers all different zones. It's done really well.
Okay, great. Go ahead, Randy.
I'm sorry. Yep. Thing is that there is the Greater Lakes Lavender Growers Association also that covers states that are, you know, Michigan, Ohio, Illinois, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, in that area.
Okay.
That's another good resource, too.
Sure. So the Great Lakes Lavender Growing Association, was that what I heard?
Yep. Greater Lakes.
Greater Lakes. Okay. So what kind of soil is best for lavender? Because that makes a big difference, doesn't it?
Yes, very important. I'll let Randy answer that.
Yeah, what you want to do as far as the soil, you want either a sandy or sandy loam soil with a pH somewhere between 6.5 and 7.5. Lavender does not like to sit in standing water, so you need to have soil that drains very quickly. Otherwise, they will die. And a lot of individuals who have lavender plants, what ends up happening is they end up overwatering them, and that ends up being most of the time the reason they end up dying. So the other thing we did besides the soil, and Kathy had mentioned that, we kind of looked at that before we kind of bought the land. I also mounded all of the rows, so that they actually sit a little bit higher. That kind of aids in the draining of the land so that they're not sitting in water.
Does that make them a little bit more susceptible for, like, frost damage?
If you have them a little higher like that above, the answer to that is yes, it does. We do cover all of our lavender every winter with a frost barrier cover. There's a couple companies. DeWitt is one company that makes the frost barrier cover, and also Agribon is another company.
So what are some good resources for the lavender plants themselves?
For the plant?
Yeah, where do you buy them?
Oh, sure. We recommend a lavender farm, because if you would go to any local retail, we just have not had luck with any of that. In the beginning, we tried that. So we've used a few farms like Washington, the state of Washington, Ohio, and Michigan.
Mm-hmm. So they actually cater for that.
Have very good results with those. And they're the little plugs, like a little 2-inch plug.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And when you buy them from there, typically they're wholesale, so you end up having to buy like a 72 count of them when you do buy them. So they're more for wholesale.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Kathy and Randy Meyer of Powder Creep Lavender in Pulaski. We're talking about their business and how to select and grow the best lavender varieties for our climate. If you have a question, please join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can also send an email to talk@wpr.org. And so let's talk about the actual the plants themselves when you put them in. How close together do they have to be?
That all depends on the variety. Go ahead, Randy.
Yeah, typically as far as, like Kathy said, is the variety. Kathy had mentioned that the lavender, depending on what variety you have, grow at different, the amount that they grow and how tall they get.
Mm-hmm.
So typically the larger ones, we put about 36 inches apart. But then the ones that are, the plants only get like 12 inches high. We'll put those like 24 inches apart. And then we have our largest ones that'll get, 4 feet high. Those are typically 42 inches apart. So it all depends on the variety. And you can look that up when you would research out a variety. And then typically they will tell you how far apart they need to be planted. And then our rows end up being 5 feet apart. And I do that so that the air can get between the lavender. If you put them too close together, they can get mold and funguses from that standpoint. So that's why we keep them kind of apart there. But that's kind of the distance.
And I've noticed that a lot of lavender farms will plant through like a fabric, black fabric, to keep the weeds down. Is that what you do?
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
It helps
if you don't, you'd be
that pop up.
Yeah, there's nothing you can do about absolutely getting those weeds to not grow up. But yeah, in between your rows, what do you use there, Randy?
We actually have let everything kind of go natural. From that standpoint, we do not use any chemicals or fertilizers or anything like that. So we do get some clover that comes up and dandelions that are in between at bearing times too. Mm-hmm. But I end up kind of mowing in between. I got a very small riding mower that I mow in between the rows. But everything is natural that comes up.
Okay, that's a good way to control it, though, just mowing. And then you have a nice little lawn in between to walk on.
Yep, and then I use a mulch mower so that the grass clippings go back into the dirt, and then they don't get all over the lavender plants also.
Okay, we've got Christy in Chippewa Falls with a question for you. Go ahead, Christy.
Hi, first a plug. We have a new lavender farm in western southern Chippewa County called Pondview Farm. Fabulous lavender plants and a beautiful facility for groups to visit. My question is, how resistant to deer and rabbit are the lavender plants?
Ooh, the bane of all gardeners' existence. Yeah.
They are very, very resistant. Deer do not touch them. Rabbits do not touch them. And we know because we have a lot of deer and a lot of rabbits. But the one enemy, vole, V-O-L-E-S, they will chew them down to the ground in the winter. Sometimes the whole row is gone.
Oh my.
That's the only, and if you look it up, it says voles do not eat lavender. Well, that's not true.
Wisconsin voles do, apparently.
Yes. And
yeah, they're very resistant to the deer and rabbits. Actually, we sold some of the lavender that we, when we trimmed the plants down, we sold them to individuals that are using them for mulch around other plants and flowers, with the hope that they will deer coming in to eat those, although they never got back to us on it.
Oh, that would be interesting to find out if that works.
But I do know they plant lavender in between the for wine out on the coast in California. They use it to keep the deer away from their vineyards.
Oh, yeah. So, Christy, it looks like you're in good shape there with lavender if you want to try to find a plant that the deer and rabbits don't like, which is kind of rare.
Right.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. So how long does it take for those new plants to produce enough for you to, like, cut them?
Well, they reach maturity at about three years. They will flower their first year, but it's recommended to pinch that off or cut them off so the roots can get more established. But, yeah, you'll have flowers by the second year, but it's good to wait till the third to really cut them all off. And their lifespan's 8 to 10 years.
Okay. So you do want to keep a rotation of plants, especially for you all with a farm.
Right.
Okay. We got an email from Deb. It's like, do you have honeybees to help with pollination? I'll bet you do.
Oh, yeah, we do. As soon as they just start to open, the bees are, it's very cool. And the butterflies, everything finds it right away.
Yeah, it's a really good plant for pollinators if you're trying to pull them into your garden, yeah. I would think.
Yes, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Now, I had read an article that said that you have that you've got beekeepers that bring in their bees. Are you still doing that?
Yeah, yes, we actually have a new one that is setting up. She started putting up some homes in the fall.
Mm-hmm. So then they get lavender honey, which I imagine tastes wonderful.
Right. It has a, yes, mm-hmm. It's a little bit different touch. It's good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you how do you know when to harvest your lavender? What are the signs of that?
Well, depending on if you want it for the buds or if you would want it for cut flowers. If you wanted it mainly for, say, culinary, you would want to try to get them when you only see a couple buds open on the plant. So right before they're all fully bloom is a good time. But more for cut flowers, for bunches, you'd want them to be close to peak, but not quite.
That's okay.
Kind of tricky. You learn the more each year you're like, oh, this is when, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Because I would assume that if you cut them too late, then everything will fall apart.
Yeah, they will lose their buds quicker if you leave them on too long. Mm-hmm.
So how do you sell your lavender?
Well, we'll sell the fresh. As bunches, or we dry them.
Okay.
We can dry the bunches and sell them for the buds or as dried stem bundles. We use the buds different.
We end up working with different businesses. We also wholesale out. So we'll wholesale out to florists, a couple different florists. And we also wholesale out to tea companies and juice companies, and depending on what you're doing with them will depend on if they want them fresh and when you need to cut them, or if they want them dried, like Kathy was talking about too. And then all the ones that we don't sell fresh, we cut those and we dry them, and then we sell the dried bundles, and we use the dried lavender and different products that we make throughout the entire year.
So what are the things that you make with them, Kathy?
Lotion, lip balm, eye pillows and neck wraps, and little sachet bags. It's a pretty long list.
How long does the lavender smell last on those?
A very long time. Sometimes I tell people, so the Egyptians used to use them in their tombs, and when they opened those tombs not that long ago, they still could smell the lavender. So you really can't, I can't, like the ones we first planted, I still have some dried bunches from 7 years ago, and you rub it and it's very strong. It's amazing. It's a wonderful scent.
It certainly is. How far down to the ground do you cut those stems?
You just go to where the woody part of the, you can tell on the plant, the greener, and then where it's woody, you will cut it right above the woody part, like a half inch above it.
Okay, so you don't want to cut the woody part of the plant itself, just the soft green stems?
Yeah.
Okay.
You can if you're cutting it down.
Okay, I'm sorry, Randy.
It's about a third of the plant, and we typically do that once they're fully bloomed. Then in August, we'll end up then starting to cut all the plants down.
Okay. So when you say cut them down, how far do you go?
And that's what Kathy has said, down to the kind of the woody area, which is typically about a third of the plant.
Okay. And what would happen if you cut them too far down? Would they then not be able to overwinter? Is that why you want to cut them at that point?
Well, so the voles did chew them all the way down to the ground, and I thought we lost hundreds of plants. They all came back. We didn't lose, maybe a handful, but so it was, they really did so much better than I thought they would be in all the way down to the ground, but we don't recommend that.
Now, go ahead, Randy.
When you read about it, they'll tell you to cut the green area, that third of the plant down each year. I've been experimenting a bit with some of them that we've cut. We've actually cut down into the woody area, and they have done fine, but you really need to, if you do that, it's only in the English lavender variety. The lavendins don't do as well if you would cut them down lower, but typically you just cut that green area off, and that's the best for them.
Now, for people who are trying to grow them in their garden, do you recommend they cut them down, or should you just leave them?
We found that the ones we don't cut down don't look as nice the next years. They're just not as healthy and vibrant. So I would recommend trimming them down after they've bloomed, like beginning of September.
Okay. What are some of the uses that you can use for the lavender, like the lavender oil? And I know you can use it for culinary.
Yes. Well, there's so many uses that I could go on and on and on. So.
Well, we've got some time, so you go right ahead.
Well, the culinary definitely for a lot of different, beverages and baking and grilling. And even the stems and the leaves are used for all the same things. You can make, drinks and potpourris.
Do you distill the lavender oil yourself, or do you get that from other places?
Because we don't have the volume. If we had like 60,000 plants, like some of the farms have that and more, then it would be worth it to distill it. But we do not distill our own here.
Okay.
You do need a large volume to make it worth it, because it takes a lot of plants to get oil.
Yeah, for sure. So what if someone wanted to grow the lavender in their regular garden, what are a few of the varieties that you would suggest that they buy?
Probably would say Folgate. It did very well for us. Melissa, if they like a whitish pink flower, is did well. Royal Velvet is very hardy here. Grosso, Munseed, and Hidcote Blue. I think that's the.
We would recommend Lavendula and Gustifolia. They do the best in the cold climates. See, like I said, the lavender don't do as well.
Okay. So you kind of got to experiment, but those are, it's a good list to start from. So when you go to your retailer, see what you can find in those. Don't buy them if they're not, because you probably are going to be disappointed, right?
Right.
Okay. All right. Well, we've been talking with Kathy and Randy Meyer of Potter Creek Lavender in Pulaski, and thank you both for being with us. We really appreciate it, and good luck this year.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. So I just want to remind you that you can join us every weekday at 11 o'clock for the Larry Mueller Show. We'll be talking about hemp and cannabis regulation on Monday. And then at noon, we'll meet some of the raging grannies who express their political outrage through song. Thanks for joining us today for Garden Talk. I want to thank our team, Claire Neipert, John Chol-Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins. And of course, Larry Mueller. I'm executive producer Jill Nadeau. Hope you join us again next time. Thanks.